There, right at the knot. So, Dana, who's back there? We got Dave, who's watching this. Cliff, all right. Am I all right? Who's in charge around here? Who's on first? All right. Am I coming through? More than you want to know, right? All right. Well, good afternoon, everybody. Ooh. Blow some of those front seats out. I don't know about you, I like fall. It's my favorite time of the year, starting in September, football season, and all the way through Thanksgiving. And I, too, appreciate the sermonette. It brings back a lot of fond memories. And, of course, the feast seems to fall right in the middle, and it doesn't get any better than that. I don't know how. Oh, everybody have a good feast this year? Ours was right up there, near one of the best we've ever had all time. We were down in New Braunfels. Followed the temperature before we got there. It was supposed to be high 70s and 80s so us Minnesotans wouldn't melt. But we got down there. It happened to decide to play little tricks on us. It hit in the 90s the first 4 days. But fortunately, we were inside in air conditioning most of the time, so it wasn't too bad. But lovely feast site down there in the hill country for those. How many have been down to New Braunfels or been Central Texas? Well, two or three of you. It's a pretty area. Anyway, we're down with some dear old friends. For those that know Stan and Judy Erickson, I would like to kid Stan as a Princeton grad. He's from Princeton, Minnesota. And dear friends for many years. Anyway, we had a wonderful feast. They had, right around New Braunfels, they had what is called a wildlife ranch. And for those of you who have never been to one of these wildlife ranches or wildlife parks, like they've got in South Africa, I've been down there too, you're able to drive through. And this one, you can have these close encounters of the animal kind. It's very millennial. You've not only got the petting zoo when you come back to the park entrance, but you drive along. They say you're not supposed to feed them, but they tell you you're not supposed to feed them. Then they give you a bag of food, free, comes right with the ticket. So we bought a couple extras, and we were driving around, and you'd open your windows, and kind of like you'd expect, the little deer, like the impalas, the gazelles, etc., they would stay away. They were skittish. But the large animals, and there were some monsters, would come right up to the car, shove their snoots in the car, looking for a snack. And we learned a couple of interesting things. First of all, for those of you who know the difference between an ostrich and an emu, you ever watch? You can't help but watch Johnny Bench, right? With Blue Emu, it doesn't stink, that type of stuff. Anyway, we had an emu on one side and an ostrich at the other, and I can tell you, emus have better car side manners. That ostrich got his neck in there, and their necks are like 3 feet long. He's in there bobbing and weaving, and you hold it out just like you do with a horse. And all the animals will eat just that way. Whether you're talking the antelope family, the deer family. Zebras, as they call them in South Africa, the zebras, and they'll just nibble right off. They're very, very friendly and didn't get bit or anything. But the ostrich, just like it was like a Gatling gun. And we had food all over the front seat. We had to clean up before we left. And the other side, the emu has got a shorter neck, maybe because he's hooked up with Johnny Bench and doing commercials. I don't know. But they put in, and they were much gentler. So it was kind of fun, I didn't know any ostrich. Do you know any ostriches? I've never met an ostrich before up close and personal. Never met an emu either, for that matter. Then there were the Sicilian burros. Anybody know anything about a Sicilian burro? I think they're connected. They came up in groups. One guy would come up front, the rest would stand them behind. They're very friendly, but you kind of got the idea that maybe you better give them something to eat, Sicilian. Anyway, we had a lot of fun. I got a little extra time, so anyway, I thought, we don't get up here that often, so I get to rattle a little bit. Anyway, I got a church-approved joke. They're all approved, but some are more approved than others. So anyway, a teenager. We got a few of those in here. We don't have any. Our youngest teenager up in Little Falls, I think, is about 64, isn't it? Yeah. Average about 75 up there. Anyway, a teenager just received her learner's permit, offered to drive her parents to church. Does that happen around you? Probably. My son happened. That happens that way. Drive her parents to church. After a hair-raising ride, they finally reached their destination. The mother got out of the car and said, "Thank you." "Anytime," her daughter replied. "As As the woman slammed the door, she said, "I wasn't talking to you, I was talking to God." Oh, boy. See, what we didn't have, do you have any snow down here? It was like 20 yesterday morning. Was it 20? No, it was the day before. It was Thursday morning, 22. And got up expecting certainly a heavy frost. All the flowers and vegetables are gone. But this is the time of year when it gets difficult to get the kids out of bed and to go to school. And for you moms that have to do that, I remember growing up, I mean, in the wintertime, you want to stay and cuddle up. And like this morning, I didn't want to get up and come here and have to preach a sermon. I just stay in. It was so nice and comfortable. So anyway, any of you moms that are going through that, this is for you. Early one morning, well, let's just put it this way. Mother Lena went up to wake up her son, Ole Jr. "Wake up, Ole Jr., it's time for you to go to school." "But why, Mom? I don't want to go." "Give me two reasons why you don't want to go," said Mama Lena. He says, "Well, the kids hate me for one, and the teachers hate me for two." "Oh, that's no reason not to go to school. Come on now, get up and get ready to go, Ole." "Oh, Ma, give me two reasons why I should go to school." "Well, for one, you're 52 years old, and for two, you're the principal." Anyway, some of us got it tougher than others. Is that too loud? I feel like I'm blowing you out here. Dave, is that... Is it okay? Well, there's nobody sleeping yet, so that's usually an indication, front row there. All right. There is a deadly creature that stalks the earth and lurks among us. It's a monster. And it has large green eyes. And it is worse than great anger and vengeful wrath. It strikes like a cancer, and yes, it can kill. It is maybe one of the worst and most deadly of all character flaws. What is this monster with eyes of green? Let's see. Turn over to Proverbs chapter 27. I'll be reading from the New International Version. Proverbs 27 and verse 4. "Anger is cruel, and fury," or "wrath, are overwhelming. But who can stand before jealousy?" Or I think a better translation is envy. Now, jealousy in this modern era has become a synonym for envy. But as we all know, God is jealous for his people. So it's got a mixed connotation. You hear jealousy, okay, we think of a jealous man or a jealous woman, that type of thing. And certainly it has that connotation, but you can also be jealous in the positive. So I like envy better. So the monster more dangerous than anger and wrath is the four-letter emotion, envy. Now, why? Why is this negative emotion that we all live with one degree or another, when we're kids, growing up, all the way through adults? And you see it scattered all over the news. You see it in Hollywood. You see it in the business world. You see it politically. It is everywhere. And it is pretty thinly veiled. We frankly live in a nation of envy. And we can see it in the way things set up. As far as entitlements, people wanting more, the redistribution of wealth, all of those things that are becoming certainly part and parcel of our political landscape and frankly our social way of life in this greatest of all nations that God has blessed. So why is this negative emotion One of many, frankly, that are dangerous. So dangerous, as the great teacher tells us. So dangerous that it is related to things that can destroy. And all I have to do is look around. It seems like daily there's somebody out kidnapping and murdering. And it was pictured. The violence that stalks this land anymore. And now it comes in such forms as Ebola and other types of diseases that are, you know, subable in nature. I mean, it's all around. It's a dangerous time in which we find ourselves. So as the teacher tells us and compares this four-letter emotion and tells us that it is on par and even more dangerous than the things we tend to relate to the great warmongers or the local pugilists in a bar, it is a story worth telling. For within its understanding, the understanding of its danger, lies a key to understanding many other deep spiritual problems. To begin our search, let's see where the metaphor, and I like to call it, I'll call it GEM, G-E-M, instead of green-eyed monster, we call it GEM, the green-eyed monster. Where'd it come from? You know, we've all heard that term growing up one time or another. Where'd it originate? Well, it seems to have come from the pen of a man who was said could write a little. The great English bard, William Shakespeare. A quote from an article on him, on the green-eyed monster. It says, green, this is Frank from a couple of his plays, one, The Merchant of Venice. Green is a color associated with sickness, possibly because people's skin tends to take a slightly yellow-green tone when they're seriously ill. Green is also the color of many unripe foods that cause stomach pains. I never thought of it that way, but yeah, that makes sense. So the phrase was used by and possibly coined by Shakespeare to denote jealousy or envy in Merchant of Venice in 1596. This is from Portia. This is her part. She's saying, how all the other passions fleet to air as doubtful thoughts and rash embrace despair and shuddering fear and green-eyed jealousy. In Othello, 1604, Shakespeare also alludes to this metaphor. In Iago's part, he says, oh, beware, my lord, of jealousy. It is the green-eyed monster that doth mock. That doth mock. Interesting. We often think of Shakespeare as that great writer that nobody likes to read because it's difficult. It's written in, you know, 16th century, you know, English language, 17th century in there. It's not easy to follow. But what they don't realize is this greatest writer of the English language, maybe any language for that matter, was a most astute observer and recorder, frankly, of human nature. Note the great power of envy or jealousy, including its not-so-subtle ability to mock. You ever related that to this? And we'll see there's a lot of other connections here. This seed, this base emotion, tends to seed a lot of other things as we go on. The base cause of many, not the least of which mockery. So kind of an interesting set of observations by the great one. Let's go back to its naked beginnings. Back to Isaiah 14, so many things start there. As we look into the mind and the heart of the being who set up so much of what we see around us, and we see bringing it to fruition, as we'll see later on. It's incredible what he's done. It's been happening. This country, this great country, has been boiled in its own, political water for many, many years, and now we're starting to see the fruits of it. Isaiah 14, verse 12 through 14. A classic area of Scripture. A lot of you probably almost have it memorized. Because we don't have a lot of Scriptures on the interworking psychologically of the being that rules this planet. But here we get a little bit of insight, here in a few other places. So in verse 12, it says, "How you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the dawn. You have been cast down to earth, you who once laid low the nations. And you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven, and I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit enthroned on the mount of assembly, on the utmost heights of the sacred mountain. And I will ascend above the tops of the clouds and will make myself like the Most High." There's a lot in there. But you have to ask the question. It begs the question. Why did Satan want a different position? Here he was obviously aspiring to something greater, wasn't he? Far greater. Ezekiel may shed a little bit of light on it, says these twin major prophets tend to give us the best look psychologically into the mind and heart that was to become Satan the devil. Started off pretty well. Lucifer, Lightbringer. Not a bad name. Chapter 28, verse 12 of Ezekiel. Here we have a little more detail. That was kind of an overview. You might say that was Satan's mission statement. Here we get into more of the... Put it this way. His modus operandi. 28, verse 12. "Son of man, take up a lament concerning the king of Tyre." And we know, of course, it's a metaphor for Satan, as we see in just a moment. And this is what the sovereign Lord says. "You were the model of perfection." Now, the king, we know the king of Tyre was not the model of perfection. But we know who was. "Full of wisdom and perfect in beauty." Boy, I'd sure like that on my resume. How about you? Young kids going out for your first time, your first job, or those switching jobs, changing jobs. Pretty good write-up. Beautiful. And they say that there supposedly is a premium that goes in the hiring process or in the performance process that beauty gets a pass or gets a premium. Wise. The model of perfection. Doesn't get much better than that. I'd sure take that on mine. In verse 13, he paints the picture going on. He says, "And you were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone adorned you." And he lists all these beautiful stones. And we now consider most of them to be precious. "Your settings and mountings were made of gold. And on the day you were created, they were prepared." So he paints a picture in more detail. Then we come to the career path. Verse 14. "You were anointed as a guardian cherub." Simple statement. Okay. Anointed could be a deacon, elder, guardian cherub, right? No big deal. "So I ordained you, and you were on the holy mount of God, and you walked among the fiery stones." Anointed covering cherub at the very throne of God. Now, I don't know where that ranked in position after the Word, who was number two, but it had to be right up there near the top, wouldn't it? I mean, if you were the anointed cherub who actually covered the throne of the two beings that ruled the universe, yeah, it'd be up there maybe as high as number three. Now, that sounds like a pretty good gig to me. Number three. Yeah, even if it was four or five. Maybe he wanted to be number two, though. Or maybe even 1B. Perish the thought. Numero uno. Maybe that was in there too. Possibly. How far can the twin character killers of pride and envy, and they state here, you know, pride and envy, are intimately involved in his decision making. In verse 15 it says, "You were blameless in your ways from the days you were created till wickedness was found in you. And through your widespread trade you were filled with violence and you sinned and you drove you in disgrace out of the holy mountain." Verse 17, "Your heart became proud on account of your beauty and you corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor. So I threw you to earth, made a spectacle of you before the kings." You can read verses 11 to 17 100 times. I probably have. Maybe more than that. And you still shake your head at these twins of spiritual destruction and what they can lead to. Pride is all about self, we know, and this is not a sermon per se, but you find it oftentimes closely coupled with envy. Self, pride is then, it's all about self. It's an unreasonable, aggrandized version of the self. And we all know people like that. Everybody's got some of it to various degrees. One of the big projects when God brings us on board, as we start to look at these scriptures that open the door to who we really are, you start to get at that pride one because it's a real door block. So it opens the door, but envy is the one that drives through. It says it is a comparative discontent. It drives. It's a driver. According to Mr. Webster, that is aroused at the sight of another's excellence or success. It's a comparative or comparison problem that ironically often dwells in the heart of those that have the most. That's kind of the irony of it. We know how God feels about comparisons over in 2 Corinthians 10:12. Just jot it down. He talks about they who compare themselves among themselves are unwise. And we all know, we've heard for years, why that is so, because every human being is unique. It's like comparing spiritual apples and spiritual oranges. Everybody's on a different program. You can't compare them. By doing, except for one. There is one comparison. Of course, we know what that is. That's Jesus Christ. Anything else is a false comparison. So here we see Satan with absolutely everything. And it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. If we tour the Old Testament, we find that even the greatest struggled with Jem, the green-eyed monster. Jacob. David. Solomon. Cain maybe was the first with the Jem disease as he looked enviously at what Abel did and what he received. It's a great irony, even today, as we observe anthropologists and sociologists, studies about such things, and who are the happiest, the most satisfied, therefore possibly the least affected by Jem? Who would you guess? The most satisfied people on the planet. Well, it's often the poorest. In fact, the pygmies of Central Africa have been studied, and according to these studies, are considered among the poorest on earth, and yet came out on top of the happy, satisfied scale. Very counterintuitive, especially with politicians trying to make everybody feel, you need to get yours. You need a piece of the pie. It's amazing poor in material goods, but rich in spiritual and emotional goods. Kind of a testament to Romans 2:14, you know, where Paul tells us that those that do not have the law are a law unto themselves, as they do the works contained in the law. I don't think there are too many pygmies I know of that are converted. Not call my grandkids when they were this tall, but that's a little different matter. It sure seems, in a great twist, like I said, counterintuitive irony, that starting with Satan, we can see the more you have, the more you want and desire. And if someone else has got it, that seems to agitate the gem, the old green-eyed monster, even more. What's going around now? He who dies with the most toys wins. I don't know who coined that, but the pygmies sure didn't get that message with their admittedly small needs. The ultimate psychology textbook is obviously the Bible. Freud and company, down through the ages, may have observed, there have been a lot of observers, including Shakespeare, we quoted him, there have been a lot of very astute observers of human nature. People who could see beyond, and like God tells us, judge righteous judgment. Get behind the scenes, dig in a little bit. Don't take first contact, first verse as gospel of everything that is said. So Freud and company, who have been observers of the human conditions psychologically and human conduct down through the ages, they get a lot of adulation from the world. A lot of people spend couch time, go to consultants or counselors of all types. But there's only one who really knows, right? The one who designed and built the model, that is Homo sapiens, human beings. He will always, the maker will always know more than about his product than those who just observe from the outside. So we've seen down through history these observers, these users of the couch, sorry Bob Newhart, really don't know very much about how we tick. They really don't. Statistics show that some 90%+ of people that go under the care of a psychiatrist or a counselor of some sort are not really helped in the long run. Many not at all. The closest to success I've heard of was the work of Viktor Frankl, who was an Austrian psychiatrist who survived World War II Nazi concentration camps. And he helped others, not all, but those he tried to help, some did make it through. And he did it by showing that life had meaning, even in the worst state you could imagine, and that we must all take personal responsibility for who we are and what we do. So he kind of had an idea, you know? It's pretty amazing insight, really, from someone from the world who believes that there is little, if any, purpose to life. Most people don't anymore. It's amazing. We had, when I was in the ministry full-time out in Connecticut, we had a gentleman come in from Israel, and he spoke to one of our spokesman's club. I may have mentioned this before, but it was amazing. He said that we know that only 10% of the Knesset there, their parliament, are religious. Well, you'd think, all right, so they're the Orthodox, the Hasidim. But the rest of them, he said, are atheists. They're not even conservative or reformed Jews. It's pretty amazing. They lost it. They said, you know, how can we believe in God that allowed, you know, the Holocaust, World War II? So anyway, Dr. Frankel made it through, was able to help some people. By the way, he believed the purpose of life was love, true love. And a man wants to blame everybody else but moi. Does that fit the modern scene or what? Nobody takes personal responsibility anymore. Kind of sounds downright scriptural, doesn't it? I think all of us realize it's the first step any of us ever took on the road to repentance and salvation. Look at that mirror. So, pretty amazing. Let's look into the ultimate psychology textbook to see what the master of masters of psychology has to say about the gem, the green-eyed monster. In Hebrew, the word for envy is kinah, Q-I-N-A-H. And translated, can mean both envy and jealousy. There are some subtle differences. For example, envy wants to take what you have, deprive you, while jealousy leans more to wanting to have or just be like. The Greek word is phthonos, P-H-T-H-O-N-O-S. Greeks had a way with putting letters together. And Vine's Dictionary in the New Testament defines it as a feeling of displeasure produced by witnessing or hearing of the advantage or prosperity of others. Now, this evil sense is always attached to the word. Unlike jealousy, which, like I mentioned, has kind of a positive connotation, and God's jealous for his people. That's why I like to use envy a little better. Besides, it has more punch to it when you say it's a four-letter word. Scripture tells us that God is jealous for his people, and that's good. But he doesn't want them to have the gem disease. Where does this basic so human emotion response lead, according to the master psychologist? Let's go over to Proverbs again, chapter 27. I just read in verse 4. This word is kinah. Let's go back there for just a moment. Read earlier, anger is cruel and fury overwhelming, but who can stand before kinah? Why is anger, or why is envy worse than anger and wrath, which God says must be controlled? There's an awful lot in the Bible about controlling anger and wrath and what it can lead to and how it can destroy a life. We know today, you know, the psychologists, sociologists are constantly, social workers, dealing with violence and anger, domestic as well as other types. Well, let's just go back a few pages. Chapter 14 of Proverbs, verse 30. A heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones. Envy rots the bones. In other words, it's like the dreaded C word, cancer, that is all too prevalent in society and, frankly, even in the church. Sad as we get the constant updates to many people in this day and age, and it's a whole other subject, but it certainly is it's a tough disease. Because like it says here, it'll eat you up inside. In this case, emotionally, spiritually, and eventually, for anybody that's ever fought an ulcer, physically. The psychosomatic diseases are real. In Job 2, we find Eliphaz telling Job that envy kills the simple, the unwise. Pretty tough series of indictments, as we see here between Solomon and Job. An old kinah. Let's see what the New Testament has to say, because I think you'll find it's interesting where it leads. Let's go over to James, New Testament. James is one relatively quiet little book tucked near the end of the New Testament. Brother James, or brother of Christ, though living with him, seems to have had a lot of insight and could speak in a common language, down-to-earth way that people could relate to. I know when you read James, you feel you come away. I understand that, as opposed to Paul. You know, by the time you get through studying Paul a little bit, you probably got a few drops of perspiration come off your forehead. You know, it's you sweat through. But when you get through with James, you know, you generally understand what he's getting at. Chapter 3, verse 13. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show it by his good life, by deeds done in humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come from heaven, but is earthly and unspiritual of the devil. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. This is the petri, this is a spiritual petri dish, a spiritual laboratory for producing a whole lot of other bad stuff spiritually, according to James. When that is found in the basic heart, it is the source of disorder and every evil practice. There's a lot there. Here we see that old satanic one too again. Envy and selfish ambition. We saw in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. Isn't envy really about not enough? God, the Father of the family of man, has given one or some of his children more, and me less. It's just like that demon that Dr. Hay encountered in Pasadena many years ago when he asked him, he says, "Why did you rebel?" And he said, "Because God is not fair, besides not having anything to compare it to." So what is implied here from a lot of people out there that have the gem, the green-eyed monster, is that God is not fair. And what he's given me is not enough. He doesn't take care of me, satisfy my needs or wants. Well, the person is a Christian and believes it all in this book. He obviously hasn't read a lot of the scriptures, like Psalm 37, 25, where David said, "I've never seen a righteous man begging bread." Of course, the old faithful memory scripture, Matthew 6, 33, just about the first thing Christ said that we have recorded, "Seek you first the kingdom of God, and all these things the Gentiles chase after will be provided." Look where it leads, very interestingly. Not to a place you'd expect. In verse 16 it said, it leads to disorder. Now you wouldn't necessarily connect those two. Now maybe every kind of evil, that maybe is a little easier to follow. Maybe not every kind, but some. He says here, every kind. Let's follow the trail of envy, of the gem. It's a deep well. In 1 Corinthians 14:33. You can jot it down. It says, God is not the author of confusion. Now, it may be in a different context there. And here it's talking about the use and the management of spiritual gifts in that context. And not my purpose to go there and spend a lot of time. The point is, the principle of God's character and the way, his way of doing things, that is his management MO, is universal and eternal in its application. God doesn't put up with confusion and chaos. Well, for too long. Now, he's done it for a while. But it's going to end. Maybe not too far down the road. You know, when you think about it, after all, how do we first meet God? In Genesis 1. We see him as the great creator. In this case, he's the universe's handyman. He's cleaning up the mess that we know now as the second flood. Or the first flood, excuse me, after the first flood. The first Holocaust, so to speak, of the creation. So we meet him cleaning up the mess, the tohu and bohu, bringing order out of chaos. Kind of reminds me, for those of you who've seen, probably most of you have seen the Ten Commandments with Cecil B. DeMille's classic with Charlton Heston. But in there, there's this point when they're coming out and getting ready to go out of Israel. They're coming out of Thebes there, and he's rounding up, you know, and brought them out of Goshen and getting them ready. And there's Joshua. Good old John Derrick standing up on a stone, and it says, Cecil B. says, and there's Joshua bringing order out of chaos. You know, I don't know if you remember that line, but stuck with me for some reason. So anyway, there's God, Genesis 1, bringing order out of chaos. Kind of reminds me, just had our 50th class reunion, and, you know, sit around, it's kind of fun. 50 years, things change. At the 40th, I could recognize everybody. At the 50th, they had to tell me who they were. There was a lot of change for those who've been through them. Anyway, it reminds me of a joke that kind of, everything reminds me of a joke. Sorry about that. Anyway, four classmates sitting at the bar. I was doing that. We were sitting around chatting and having a drink, reminiscing. In this case, it was a lawyer, doctor, engineer, and a politician. And they were discussing whose profession was the oldest. First, the lawyer said, remember that first litigation case, Cain versus Abel? Doctor says, not so fast. Remember that first operation? Took a rib out of Adam and made Eve. He says, the engineer says, got you both beat. Remember that great engineering feat when God created order out of chaos? Politician just sits there smirking, says, hey boys, where do you think all that chaos came from? Yeah, I know that one all right. So anyway, that's how we meet God, cleaning up the chaos that Satan had made. Remember the name of Satan's system and its meaning? We don't often think about it, but it's Bad Old Babylon, right? A system built and sustained by confusion. Confusion. Starting to see the link? Satan didn't have enough. And it led to what, according to James? Confusion. And this whole system that we see around us is built on confusion. All we have to do is look at the world today. This economic system. What's the number one reason businesses aren't expanding and hiring over the last several years? Slowest recovery, frankly, of any major recession or depression. It's uncertainty. Chaos coming out of, unfortunately, old Foggy Bottom. Washington diseased. It's modern Babylon on diabolical steroids. It kind of reminds me of a saying. We as a company didn't go along with this, but he used to say this. An old retired salesman from our company. He used to say, in confusion there is profit. And you see a lot of that these days. Unfortunately, like I said, we never put up that, but he had a way with words, observing things. Well, so it is with Satan's modern version of Babylon, confusion the great, as John calls it. And where there is chaos and confusion, people are disoriented and they're not happy. And that's where Jem leads, according to James and the others. Now, I've often been intrigued by the subtle, the deep wisdom of one of our great homespun philosophers. How many remember Will Rogers? He's been dead for a long time. Yeah, some of them. You remember Will Rogers. He could turn a phrase. He was good. Now, don't take this wrong, and I'm going to qualify this, but just to show what we've come to in this day and age. And I'll balance it out. It'll be fair and balanced here. Just hang on. But he was known to have said, he says, I don't belong to any organized party. I'm a Democrat. If I remember that. Like I said, I'm not picking on Democrats. Republicans have plenty of their own problems. But I merely bring it in context of James 3:16, of the disorder that is linked to envy. And we know that envy is ruling. You don't have to read deeply and widely to see the envy that is created by class warfare, the envy that's created by the desire for income redistribution, which is diametrically opposite to what God's system in the Bible points out. The parable of the talents in other places. You're rewarded by your efforts. And because you're not as wealthy as somebody else, the pygmy principle or phenomena. Happiness, frankly, has little to do with income and everything to do with state of mind and character. So in a sense, we're looking into the liberal mind for a moment here in this context, recalling that it was such minds that produced gave us socialism, communism, evolution, the death of God. Great articles, by the way, in the recent Good News by Tom Robinson. Done a lot of research. The welfare state and no personal responsibility, etc., etc., etc. Now remember, the right gave us Nazism, fascism, Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Dachau, etc., etc., etc. You might say they're both equal opportunity forms of tyranny with tyrants and despots. Doesn't really make a lot of difference. It's all funneled. It's all basically energized by the same thing we've just been reading about. Nothing to be proud of on either side. It's interesting how Satan is able to manipulate the basic tendencies of human beings, the liberal and the ultimate, you know, conservative mind, push his agenda. And I'm not saying that there aren't right principles out here, the conservatives. We tend to be more conservative as a church in the way we approach things, but frankly, there are things that conservatives probably wouldn't go along with either that Christ would have. So it's not a perfect matchup for sure. But I find it interesting that God includes, like I said, disorder and chaos with evil of every kind in verse 16. It is very interesting. Let's notice another interesting connection and relationship between two neighbor and commandments of the Big Ten. James had said that every kind of evil, and of course the Ten Commandments basically outline all the evil that is out there, and you dissect them and analyze them, you find everything will fit under one of those categories, those Big Ten. Number 10, covetousness. What is that? That's envy, right? The gem, the green-eyed monster. And it says it is as idolatry, for it steps in front of the Creator who made and owns us all, according to Colossians 3:5. Next to 10, we find number 9, the signature trait of Satan's character. What's he called? The father of lies. And it's with this seminal trait of evil, of James 3:16, that he builds his diabolical kingdom and system, Babylon the Great. Chaos Incorporated. Kind of sounds like a James Bond protagonist, doesn't it? Chaos. I think it was, actually, in one of them. Now, how does that work? I may have mentioned this before, but I'm going to mention it again because it's hit me right between the eyes, like few things I have witnessed in the last 30 or 40 years. And it basically set the table prophetically to where we are, or at least gives us a pretty good idea. According to what Mr. Armstrong used to say. Remember he used to say, you want to find out where we are in society? Take a look, human beings. Go down the boiler room, like he said. Don't look at the thermometer. Go down the boiler room. Well, the boiler room of human psychology and activity these days is pretty clear. Well, anyway, on Fox News, and they seem to be one that's a little more conservative and fair and balanced than some of the others, had an interview. And I don't remember who the interviewer was, with Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, our neighbor. Paul Ryan is one of these guys, you see him off and on, that you'd like your sister to marry. Kind of the boy next door, clean cut, good family life, a lot of friends. Sharp man. He ran as the vice president. So they interviewed him and talked about why he got into politics and all these things. And at the end they said, obviously, politics is a dirty game. Why'd a nice guy like you kind of, you know, get into this? Well, he gave the standard answer. He thought he could make a difference. I said, what's the real downside? You know, what's the real challenge going on today? And he looked into the camera and he said, in Washington, D.C., everybody lies. And then he put his finger right into the camera and he says, they lie right to your face. That sent a shiver down my spine. Because that told me that the capital of the greatest nation in the history of mankind was now totally in the clutches of the father of lies. That he had his clutches deep within the bowels of the Capitol and the White House and the court of our capital city. Now, I'm sure he didn't mean absolutely everybody, but it's a pretty broad brushstroke. He says everybody. Just like the Bible at times, doesn't mean absolutely, but it's pretty amazing. I'm still blown away. Because we've been boiled like the proverbial frog. It's come gradually from the days of Darwin. And this latest series of articles by Tom Robinson, The Good News, shows just how thoroughly God has been removed from the marketplace of ideas in the institutions of this country, and frankly, the Western world. We're close. Really close. So how does destroying the sacred ninth create disorder? Along with the tenth and the ninth working together, right there together. Well, it's probably a blinding flash of the obvious, maybe too obvious to need explanation, but indulge me for a moment. What happens when people start lying to each other? Because they want something. Usually people lie, and right now it's going around that Machiavelli of Italy has taken over Washington. That the ends justify the means, and that's what Ryan was talking about, that individuals feel that their agenda is worth lying about at every single point. Because they want something. So nobody trusts each other anymore. And they really don't know what's going on. It's tough in the business world. You get people that lying you can't trust. We run into a few of them in our business. We don't want to do business with them anymore. Willing to walk away. But that's the way it is today. And then what happens? Then you have true chaos and confusion. And Babylon arrives on steroids. And that's where we are today. Because nobody knows what's really going on. They start to take things into their own hands. I've read articles recently. We're real close to a revolution, a revolt, kind of like Judges 21:25, the day in which everybody did which was right in their own eyes, making it up as they go. Paul Ryan's City of Prevarication. Nobody knows what's going on anymore in Babylon. Confusion. Nobody can plan. They don't know what the insurance rates are. They can't hire. They don't know what the tax bite is. They don't know what the environmental regs are. You know, in business, you know the challenge that can be. And the political game playing and subterfuge poured out without end. It's an amazing time. So we're smothered with lies of envy. They link just like that, 9 and 10. Lying is the heart of Satan, because he's full of envy. And he knows that's the way to destroy, and he's got us believing that as a people, as God's children. Proverbs 29:2. It's all right, could use some special music. Need a break. Pretty intense up here. 29:2, when the righteous thrive, the people rejoice. When the wicked rule, the people groan. Don't we all yearn for the simpler times, a less chaotic time of leave it to Beaver and Father knows best? Under leaders we could trust. Just saw a special this morning, they were talking about Ronald Reagan. Maybe the last great leader we've had. Oh, where have all the good men gone? It's very interesting to note how James set up this powerful section of his letter. The first 12 verses, which we didn't read, are all about what? The human tongue. Aren't they? The exit way of the mind. What a powerful tool it is for both good and evil. As we canvass back over history, recall the great orators and their impact on their time and circumstances. Oh, we long for that. For good and evil, Adolf Hitler with "The Third Reich will reign for 1,000 years. He had him believing it. After the First World War and the Weimar Republic, and reparations of the Versailles Treaty, put him in a Great Depression. Versus Winston Churchill, was personally willing his tired and crippled little island with its nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat, and rallying them to let us therefore brace ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last 1,000 years, men will say this was their finest hour. Bad impersonation, but you get the idea. Of course, our own Abe Lincoln in Gettysburg, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. We don't have them like that anymore. The power of the tongue, James knew. He linked it then to those scriptures we just read, 13 on. And when inflamed by the gem, like in Adolf Hitler's case, Lebensraum for the Germans, living room. And we know the result. He well knew where it led. Go back there to James 4. Because you see, built on James 1 or 3, 1 through 12, It naturally leads to what we find in James 4. From the tongue to envy, and the result, James 4. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You want something, but you don't get it. You kill and covet, but you cannot have what you want. You quarrel and fight, and you do not have because you do not ask God. And when you ask to receive with wrong motives, that you may spend it on your own pleasures. That's where it led. He tied it all together. The tongue led by Jem leads to war. And we can see that as we slouch to Gomorrah on the road to Armageddon, the forces that are taking us there. So as we all tackle the gem in our own personal lives, we're all led back to one inescapable conclusion about envy. And that is God, who designed and created us, absolutely knows how to make us happy. That may be, depending on your circumstances, what you came out of, what type of life before you were called. Most of us probably weren't all that happy. We were searching for something. And God was then able to draw us to the vital truths of His plan of salvation. But we do know He knows how to make us happy, fulfilled, satisfied. And therefore we need not envy, because it doesn't satisfy. We have billions of angels that are going to go someday into a place called Tartaru and spend, as far as we know, the rest of eternity weeping and gnashing their teeth. A very unhappy group of beings, because they wouldn't listen to God. So as we saw, God knows it's not envy. You can see where that leads to war. On all levels of life, personal, all the way to worldwide. In other words, combating envy, the gem, is a matter of believing and faith. Faith in Him who designed and created us and has an incredible desire to see all of us happy and fulfilled. Just like we do with our children. But there are times He has to exercise tough love, as we well know. And tough love is coming for the world, probably in not too many years. So we just have to trust that He knows what He is doing. And that's not easy for human beings, to relinquish, to submit unconditionally their will. Because the human will, the free moral agency that God gave us, is the thing that separates us from animals. Contrary to the Darwinites and the Neo-Darwinites. Three simple scriptures sum it all up. There are many others, but these are three that I kind of hang on to. And how to beat old Jim. And make for excellent prayer and meditation review every day. Proverbs 3, 5 through 6. Trust the Lord with all your heart and lean not to your own understanding. Acknowledge Him in all your ways and He will direct your path. A very simple summary of the game of life and how to run it. The path that leads to Matthew 5, 48. The greatest concept any human being could ever know and come to understand. We can become like our Father is in heaven, and it is expected to become part of His family. Matthew 6:33, as I mentioned before. If you seek that path, He will provide all the provisions along the way that you need to complete the journey for your earthly trip. says all that you need to be happy. Not some, not most, but all that you truly need. And remember, we don't always know what we need. He does. He's the designer, remember, the maker. He has the original product manual. And finally, Romans 8:28, when you hit a pothole on that journey, rest assured that He allowed it. And it's for your own Matthew 5:48 good. Those three scriptures sum it up. It's kind of like the Jews with their phylacteries. Carry a little note card. Things get tough. There it is. There's the summary. Paul may have recorded it best in 2 Corinthians 12:9. After dealing with one of those many spiritual potholes, and just got to read 2 Corinthians 11. Every so often, it's the Bible's own book of martyrs, the challenges. I mean, Paul wasn't martyred. Well, he was. When you're killed for the work of God, I'd say that's martyrdom. I mean, he was probably resurrected at least a couple times, as far as we can tell. Thrown out on the city dump for dead. God may have had to resurrect him. We don't know what state he is in. So there he says, after dealing with one of these potholes, he says, "My grace is sufficient." Now, it was in reference to being healed of a particular affliction. But it sums up the program. It sums up the program. My grace is sufficient. I know what's best for you. For only I truly know what you really need. Freud and company don't know. The politicians and Foggy Bottom don't know, nor their counterparts in every other capital around the world who are trying to bring happiness to the tired and huddled masses. As it says in Romans, who groan waiting for the coming of the family of God and His kingdom. For only I truly know. Truly need in both the short and the long term to slay the gem, the green-eyed monster. I can provide that on your way, on the path to Matthew 5:48. Happiness and satisfaction both now and for eternity. And why? Because indeed, Father always knows best.